What you're about to experience is one man's quest to see beyond the tumultuous period we're in and to envision what lies just beyond our grasp, yet well within our reach. Welcome to Larry Rifkin's America Trends, where the future has arrived, and it's just in time.
Let me go to the trade wars, because you know more about this stuff than just about anybody I can imagine. And I want to be quick about this, because I've got so many questions to ask you.
Okay, sure.
And when we look at what the levers are as it relates to trade, I'm looking at tariffs, quotas, currency, devaluations. Right. In other words, what are the tools in the toolbox that any country can use against another or in relation to another? And what is America doing right now in relation to the European Union, China, Canada, and on certain goods and services, not all, of course, but where is our strategy at the moment? And do you think it's a good strategy?
Well, first of all, let's not forget subsidies, which are a major tool by which governments all over the world wind up incentivizing a lot of economic activity within their own borders, but also luring economic activity from foreign countries to their own countries.
And is that best exemplified in the Chinese economy, where, in fact, they may state control or near control so much of the activity?
That's right. And the Chinese economy is certainly a major case in point. And on top of being able to offer businesses all over the world still extremely low labor costs by any reasonable standards, practically no regulation, they are also willing to offer major subsidies for land use, for water use, for electricity use. They're also willing to offer, or certainly have in the recent past, a major currency subsidy. They'll say, we're going to essentially hold the value of our currency so low that any product that's created within China is going to be extraordinarily price competitive in all global markets.
Okay,
and that's a big advantage for all manufacturers.
So just so everybody understands, tariffs, subsidies, quotas, currency devaluation, a lack of environmental regulation, labor costs that are low.
Sure.
These are all the tools. Now, who is best around the world using those now? And are we at such a great disadvantage as we are told today in relation to China or Europe or Japan? Where are we most in deficit on these issues? Not that we want to replicate many of these issues by any means. Is the Chinese example the one that's most stark?
It seems to me that China is clearly in a class by itself, but it's also followed closely by many of the smaller East Asian economies that have become pretty important global manufacturing and also trading powers. And the European Union is no slouch either.
But they have much higher labor costs, and I don't think they necessarily have the currency issues quite in the same way that China does. What is it that they're doing to our goods? Is it tariffs? Is it the VAT tax? What is it that they're doing to blunt our impact in terms of American goods?
Their labor costs are relatively high, although what's not widely known is that Germany has been extremely successful for the last roughly 15 years in driving wages down. Germany decided back in the late 1990s it was no longer wage competitive, it was no longer price competitive, and it was going to drive German workers' wages down. It's been very successful at that. European Union has played an awfully interesting currency devaluation game also, because the common currency that's been adopted by members of the so-called Eurozone, and they're not exactly the same countries comprising the European Union, but there's a lot of overlap, certainly among the larger economies. And when that euro was originally introduced back in the early 1990s, there was an almost universal expectation that it would wind up soon being just as strong as the U.S. dollar. and therefore wouldn't give Europe any special trade advantages. That's been far from the case. And the big beneficiary has been Germany, because when Germany was on its own, the German mark was extremely strong because Germany was a very well-run economy, and a lot of overseas investors had a lot of faith in it and were willing to hold marks and were willing and anxious actually to acquire them. But now Germany is inside that Eurozone and has been a major beneficiary of this unexpectedly weak currency. And also, you had mentioned value-added taxes.
Yeah.
That's a big trade barrier throughout Europe, and it's also a big trade subsidy for European goods headed outside Europe, because when European goods are sent overseas for consumption overseas, that value-added tax gets lifted.
And what about the United States in relation to some of these maneuvers? Where are we, say, helping our currency? Where are we trying to protect American goods? Heretofore, what have we been doing during, say, the last 20 years?
The main so-called weapon that the United States has been employing has involved the use of a trade law system that was generally put into place in the first few decades of the 20th century, that, as I see it, has proven to be completely ineffective in combating or curbing the kinds of predatory foreign trade practices that victimize U.S. companies, both trying to compete with what people call fairly traded imports coming into this country, and that also have to try to overcome these very formidable foreign trade barriers. And the main problem with this trade law system entails weaknesses that all legal systems suffer from. Not that I don't like legal systems, especially when they're used to structure and to regulate activity happening solely within this country. But when we're talking about trying to use the U.S. legal system to cope with foreign problems, we run into big trouble because, like all legal systems, it's very reactive and it's very episodic, meaning and what I mean by that last term is it's only able to handle problems and complaints as they come up case by case individually. And we're facing structural problems. We're facing system-wide national organizations of trade protection, and when you're talking about China, I would argue trade predation. And this episodic, reactive U.S. legal system has proven completely inadequate.
Okay, so now we're trying to rectify this. Now, you talked about a lot of the protocols having been put in place in the early 20th century, and I think that's what you meant, not the 21st
sure.
century.
Yes, but, I'm sorry.
But when we go back and we look at NAFTA, which was mm-hmm. negotiated, you know, within the last 30 years, and we look at some other agreements, of course, that we've been working on, were we not trying to iron out some of these disparities in the context of those agreements, and where did they go off the rails if they have?
That was what the American people were told, but in fact, U.S. trade policy set none of those goals whatever, and I would point to two specific problems. One has to do with trade agreements like NAFTA, and trade agreements like NAFTA resulted in a major change taking place in U.S. trade policy before NAFTA, before the early 1990s, before the Cold War came to an end. The main aim of U.S. trade agreements was either to shore up American military alliances and secondarily to try to create more opportunity for U.S.-based producers to sell their products overseas. When the Cold War came to an end, U.S. leaders decided that a fundamentally new strategy was needed for two basic reasons. One, there was a whole new category of enormously populous but very poor third world countries that were coming on stream into the global economy that had previously been essentially state-controlled. But the collapse of communism discredited that model, and those countries, to varying degrees, at varying speeds, adopted certain free market reforms that made them look very promising to American producers. And secondly, a conventional wisdom emerged that the American economy had reached a stage of what was called maturity. It was no longer able to generate satisfactory growth by simply selling to its own citizens. It had to try to access foreign markets much more energetically. And what we were told was that these new so-called emerging market countries, Mexico, China, Indonesia, etc., were going to become sources of huge numbers of consumers that would be willing and able to buy from Americans. And the problem is that those claims were completely deceptive and completely misleading.
But when we look at NAFTA, mm-hmm. I mean,
right.
Mexico.
Classic example.
Okay, but their country and their economy, has it been growing? Have we been able to penetrate that market? And Canada, I'm very confused about our relationship with Canada,
right.
And how reciprocal that has been. As you know, quickly as we can we pierce
sure,
that?
Absolutely.
Because there's so many other topics I want to get to.
Of course, Mexico has been the classic so-called emerging market story. It's been touted as a huge actual and, more important, potential pool of customers that were just chomping at the bit to buy American products. But Mexico, still 25 years or so after NAFTA went into effect, is still way too poor to be a net buyer of U.S. goods. And even most U.S. exports that go to Mexico aren't bought by Mexican consumers. They go to Mexican factories, often owned by U.S. and other foreign multinational companies. They're parts and components of products like automobiles and refrigerators and computers and various other electronic products. They are turned into those final products in those Mexican factories, and they're sent right back here.
But having said that, that's another argument about this trade war, is that we're all so melded together now that you may have a car that is assembled in Mexico, but it's got a lot of components that were made in Michigan or Ohio or whatever. And so if we start slapping tariffs and the like and begin to make all this more costly, then ultimately it comes back and bites both those manufacturers of those components in America and the consumers who ultimately will buy them, many of whom are in America.
Sure. There's no question that I think that President Trump has done this country no service whatever in suggesting and actually stating explicitly that these so-called trade wars will be easy to win. Anytime you're talking about major policy overhaul like this, you're talking some short-term cost and you're talking disruption by definition. But it's also critical to remember that the multinational companies whose supply chains are supposedly at risk are very adept at moving supply chains, especially in response to tariff pressure.
Okay, so you're saying that we can win this. You had a post recently saying mm-hmm. that a trade war is winnable by the United States, yet you're saying that President Trump should not be suggesting that this is going to be easy. So how is it winnable, and does he have a strategy, as you see it, to win this thing?
Well, I'm not sure that he has an especially coherent strategy, but the basic idea seems to be that if so many other foreign countries use tariff barriers, use various other kinds of trade pressures to lure U.S. manufacturing to their borders,
that we can reverse engineer all this?
Certainly we can do the same thing and more, because the size of our market is so much greater.
Well, you've always said that our winning point in all of this is the fact that everybody wants the American consumer market.
And everybody needs it. All businesses need it if they're going to be world-class companies, if they're going to achieve that kind of scale. There's no other market that is so immense and that remains so open. And but, that's what U.S. trade policy needs to capitalize
but on. But when we look at these other countries and other unions and so forth, and with China growing and indicating that ultimately their consumers want more of what they're going to be making and others are going to be making, I mean, can the Chinese economy absorb a lot of that consumer demand? And will some of the other growing economies in the world take up the slack for an America that may be more isolated from the rest of the world?
Well, first of all, even though that financial crisis and Great Recession on a worldwide basis are still near, are just about, you know, 10 years behind us in the rearview mirror, we are still living in a very slow growth world. And we're also living in a world where most non-U.S. major economies are trying to rely on exports and on amassing trade surpluses for their growth. They are not relying principally on selling to their own customers. And so many of their exports have to be headed to the United States because that's been the major exception. And regarding China specifically, if the Chinese government really thought that China was making great progress toward being able to rely on its own market, mm-hmm. on its own consumers, to achieve what it considers to be adequate levels of growth, it wouldn't still be working so hard to stimulate exports.
So let's look at this. We're in the midst of a trade war. And in fact, as we are speaking, there are some new tariffs going on Chinese goods in the next several hours. Where are we in this war? And how do we know when we're beginning with our strategy to have an impact? And do you think we've got the political will to fight this war?
That last question, Larry, is at this point the most important one of all, because it's clear to me anyway that this country's foreign trade competitors are counting on the U.S. cracking first, because the American political system is so fragmented, because there is so little consensus, certainly within U.S. leadership classes outside of the Trump administration, that trade policy urgently needs to be changed, that these foreign governments are counting on stoking political pressures and essentially forcing President Trump to back down. And it seems to me that the main evidence can be seen when you look at those U.S. products that are facing the highest foreign tariffs. We're talking about farm products, which has been widely observed to come from states that were major pro-Trump states during the 2016 election.
So the American farmer really is feeling the pinch.
He will probably start to, although, again, we have to remember American farm prices and farm incomes have been in the toilet for 5 years at least now, because there's been overproduction. That's not President Trump's fault.
But aren't we also a nation that does subsidize our farmers?
We subsidize agriculture tremendously.
Right.
And it's no surprise that the result has been surplus production.
Mm-hmm.
So there are clearly major reforms that need to be made in America's domestic agriculture policy, too.
Did the last farm bill deal with any of that?
Not fundamentally, no.
All
no,
right.
It was basically more of the same.
So we look at where we are today, and you've got a lot of congressional Republicans who have
right.
been free traders over the years, and now they're stepping back, they're looking at what the president is doing, and they're saying, well, maybe he has a wily way of dealing with this, maybe he is the art of the deal man, but I'm not going to give it too long before I start hearing constituencies of mine, whether it's with steel or with aluminum or any of these other things that you know, go into making of cars, and we've got the car manufacturers and GM beginning to bristle at all of this, the farmers, before they step back and say, Mr. President, this is a bridge too far.
These Republican lawmakers are, I think, being whipsawed by two conflicting forces. There's no question that many American companies are complaining louder and louder about the possible effects of these Trump tariffs. And there's also no question that these same companies have been major funders of these Republican senators and House members, too. At the same time, I keep reading newspaper article after newspaper article where journalists will talk to workers who were employed by these same companies that presumably would be hurt to some extent anyway by these Trump tariffs. And these workers say, A, that they're still with him, and B, something really does need to be done regarding trade policy. And that is entirely consistent with the clear reality that the Republican base, Republican voters outside of that donor class, have converted to Trumpers when it comes to trade policy.
But how long will it take for these other countries to acquiesce, given the importance of the U.S. market? Because we are short-term thinkers, whether we look at it quarterly in terms of results for corporations or the next election, we're not long-term. And President Xi is sitting there in China making investments all over the world to get access to those markets. And he's got, well, a lifetime appointment. And Donald Trump may be out of office even sooner than the end of his first term. So what happens here in America as you see it?
He's got a lifetime appointment, and I'm certainly not saying that he faces any major near-term threats to his hold on power. But we should also remember dictatorships, even the seemingly strongest ones, can turn out to be very brittle and can run into major trouble very suddenly. But again, that's really the $64,000 question, which is whether the unquestionable market power and the unquestionably superior market power that the United States enjoys in these current and possible future trade conflicts will be more important than that short-termism, both the economic short-termism that we've spoken about and that political short-termism that stems from our obsession with our frequent elections. Which force is going to win?
And if you were a betting person, what would you say?
If I were a betting person, I would say that America's market power seems to have the upper hand now, precisely because voters who are the political actors that count most in the near term and long term seem to be sticking with President Trump, and also because there have been signs that various forces within America's foreign trade competitors have been lobbying their own governments to come to some kind of a deal, and in particular the German automobile industry, which is extremely powerful over there and which is heavily reliant on exports.
But they also make a lot of those German cars in South Carolina and in other places in the South. I mean, tell us what that confluence of interests, where that falls in this trade battle.
They certainly slap together a lot of cars here in both South Carolina, in the case of BMW, in Alabama, in the case of Mercedes, but those cars are still overwhelmingly made from German parts, which is one reason why those auto workers in those southern states employed by those German companies are still pretty poorly paid.
Our attention span in America is so limited, and our
I worry about that too.
For any pain, short-term or long-term, and I don't care what the president says about this economy, to me, it's still a house of sand and cards. And so I just don't know how long and how much time and how much political capital he has to wait for the first country to really fold its tent on some of these things. Do we have to see that soon from someone?
I'm not sure we'll have to see that soon for two basic reasons. One, when we're talking about China in particular, the Chinese government, again, doesn't seem to face any prospect that it's going to see its hold on power lost or even significantly weakened. So that's a major asset that's working in China's favor. But what could be a more important advantage working in America's favor is the fact that as much damage as trade policy has done to the productive heart of this country's economy, we're still so enormous and we're still so relatively invulnerable to trade developments that it seems likely to me anyway that we'll be able to generate enough growth, enough job creation, and enough gains in wages, however unsatisfactory they've been so far, to keep a critical mass of the American electorate reasonably happy.
But we're renegotiating now a lot of deals around the world. NAFTA, we hear that that continues to go on. I mean, at some point, because we are so dependent upon the news cycle, somebody's got to tell us that these tariffs in particular are working. I don't know what else we're using in our bag of tricks. We hear about the tariffs. So what do you expect to hear, and what other strategies should we be employing here?
I do expect to see, certainly, and hear about more news coverage about more and more U.S. companies complaining that they're running into major trouble because of the spreading effects of the Trump tariffs. However, I'm also expecting to read and hear about more and more foreign companies relocating production or simply moving the production from overseas to this country because they're worried by that exact same Trump tariff spread. They want to make sure that they can continue to access U.S. customers. And we've already seen many examples of that.
You say, of course, that localized manufacturing is something that we are going to be naturally moving toward in the near future. And, of course, Paul Krugman from the New York Times disagrees, talking about the disruption of the supply chain argument. You say that that can quickly be moved, that they can come back to the United States in record time if they choose to do that. Are they repatriating a lot of those dollars based upon the tax law and tariffs, or is one more important than the other in terms of getting that money and that activity back in the U.S.?
I think we're still early enough in the game where we really haven't seen the full effect of those tax cuts, and especially of those provisions of the Republican tax bill that were aimed at encouraging enormous pools of money that multinational companies were keeping overseas to come back here. There's no question that practically every survey that's been taken of large company executives tells us that they're going to use most of that repatriated money, i.e., that money coming back here to pay for stock buybacks. But some will be used for investment. Some will be used, for new investment. But again, I do think we're going to see a continuing flow of foreign companies either building new factories here or moving factories that they might have once had here that they had offshored, moving them back. And I just think we're going to have to wait at least quite a few months to see which force is the strongest one.
In closing, trade in the past has been a precipitant to war. The inability to get certain resources for your country, and a country responds in kind militarily. I know the president's been talking about security concerns as part of the entire dynamic here in terms of trade. We've got to bring some of this back so that if we do have to go to war, we have more control over those processes. Are you worried at all that we are going to so unsettle what has been a global order that we run the risk of a confrontation of a military sort?
I'm not so much worried about trade conflict leading to actual military conflict. To me, the main sources of military conflict that have appeared around the world in recent years really don't have much to do with trade policy at all. They have to do with the desires of the Russian government and the Chinese government to gain what they consider to be, to regain what they consider to be their lost superpower status. These are two countries that feel that they have been, to be sure, during different time periods, elbowed off center stage of world politics. They want back in, and that's why the Chinese have been seeking to expand their territorial reach throughout East Asia and why Russia has been much more active along its own borders trying to increase its own influence than it was in those early post-Cold War years.
But isn't it true that China has been able to do a lot of this adventurism because they've gotten such a rich taste of the international economy that they are free now to rebuild if, in fact, we begin to pull back on that because we don't offer access to our markets or import a lot of their goods, that in fact we may be leading them to a place where they would get more confrontational?
No, there's no question that the immense trade profits China has made off the United States since the early 1990s and the enormous and reckless flows of defense-related technology that U.S. companies have channeled toward China, while Washington has unforgivably looked the other way, have greatly strengthened the Chinese military. No question about it. What I worry about is that so many resources and so much technology have come China's way that China is rapidly approaching a point of self-sufficiency. It's not there yet, and I still think that can be prevented, but time is really running short on that front.
Well, we will see whether America has the stomach for a trade war that you say
that's exactly the question.
Yeah.
That's exactly the question.
And that you say is winnable in the end, but again, our deadlines are not long into the future, given political elections and controversy and constituents rising up in the meantime. Well, listen, I want to thank you as always, Alan Tonelson, Reality Check, CHEK. And Alan, give us all the pertinence where people can reach and read your penetrating work.
Thank you so much, Larry. That website's address is www.alantonelson.wordpress.com. So that's alantonelson.wordpress.com. And I also tweet like a house on fire.
I know you do.
Follow me on Twitter at, I guess it's @ Alan Tonelson.
All right, wonderful. Alan, thank you so much. Trade wars and the economy, we can't begin to tell you what it means to help us put all this in perspective. It really is important.
My pleasure as always, Larry. Thanks for having me.
Thanks for being part of America Trend.